Welcome to Trauma-Informed Caring, an Essential Conversations podcast, brought to you by the Mid-America Addiction Technology Transfer Center, funded by SAMHSA, the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. Although funded by SAMHSA, the content on this podcast does not necessarily reflect the views of SAMHSA.
We have seen in the research and in real life that well-being inspires well-doing. So we want to invite you as we begin to take just a moment and pause whatever you're doing if you can and focus on your own well-being by joining us in this centering practice.
Think of something simple that you like and have access to. So in this moment, plant your feet on the ground. If you like to, close your eyes. Take that deep breath in and slowly breathe out through your mouth. Notice the image. What smells, tastes, textures, sounds go with the image? What positive sensations do you feel in your body as you notice, as you bring this to mind? Take another deep breath in and slow breath out. Notice what is positive about this experience for you, as if it is a bell that chimes and dissipates. And when you are done, take a deep breath in and out.
And as you are ready, you may release this practice. I'm Roxanne Pendleton.
And I'm Andrea Dalton.
And this is Trauma-Informed Caring, our leadership series. We want to thank Vlad, our first guest. Thank you, Vlad, for leading us in that centering practice. And go ahead and introduce yourselves to our listeners.
Sure. My name is Vladimir Sante. I am a licensed clinical social worker. I currently work at the Children's Place as the clinical director of counseling and family support services.
Great. Thank you for being with us. And Andy, tell us about you.
Yeah, thank you. My name is Andy Campbell, and I am the principal at Summit Ridge Academy, which is the alternative school in the Lee Summit R7 school district.
Excellent. And Lee Summit, for those of you who may not know, is in the greater Kansas City metropolitan area.
Thank you both for joining us today. We're really looking forward to this conversation because we have had the opportunity to interact with both of you a lot in the past, doing different trauma-informed care related things. And so we're excited to kind of dig into what you've been able to do and how that's gone. And so I think the question I kind of want to lead off with today is related to any resistance that you have encountered as you have tried to integrate more trauma-informed practices into your work or your life.
You're not pulling any punches today. Yeah, we're going right to the hard stuff.
Yep. So any resistance and how you've kind of navigated that, maybe in a trauma-informed way, because I think that that can be a challenge for sure as we think about change, culture change, and you know, leading through times that are really difficult in organizations and in life, in the world, right? There's a lot going on right now. You know, there's always a lot going on, but particularly now layering on the pandemic with everything else that's been happening in our society. So whoever wants to kind of tackle that first.
As a manager, I'm finding new ways to kind of lean in to which managerial style that suits my personality, my values, my belief systems. I'm leaning more into coaching with compassion instead of coaching for compliance. The reason I say this is because I see a change when we interact with the people we work with, when we are operating from a more trauma-informed and responsive lens. I used to have a staff and she was a clinician and I would always check in. I always check with my staff. I always ask a Likert scale, 1 to 10, 1 being in the dumps, 10 being amazing. How are you doing in this moment? She would dislike it. She fought that thing tooth and nail. Every session, she would say that she's at a 5.5. And I would counteract by asking, well, how can we get you to a 6? What does a 6 look like? And you'll have to forgive me because like I'm a squirrel, so my thought process are going to be all over the place. But the challenge there was just to help her to understand that she is more than just production. She's a human being and the human person matters first. Under knowing little bits about her history and work experiences, I knew that and knew the best way to interact with her was to treat her like a human. One of my values as a social worker is dignity and worth of the person.
That speaks to the kind of individual resistance I think that sometimes we can encounter when we try to manage or lead in a different way than maybe how someone is used to being treated.
And that's so true because like there was a lot of organizational trauma that she experienced and she did not have a manager that actually treated her like a person. She was so used to someone telling her, checking on her production, her clients, but not her as a human. So when I did it, it was this eek. This is not genuine. This doesn't feel real. Why are you asking me how I'm feeling? let's just get to the punchline. What do you need from me as my supervisor? And that was a trigger for me because that's just not how I want to operate. Mm-hmm. So it took a lot of coaching and just letting her know, like, you come first as a person.
That speaks to what I was wondering, Vlad, which is if your style of leadership somehow makes a person feel unsafe at the beginning, right? Because it's different. It's new. Can I trust it? Why are you asking me these questions? This is so personal. Right? What are some tips you would give people to help that feel more safe?
So I learned this the hard way. A good friend of mine always told me that when you're having a challenging situation with someone, view them as your kind teacher. I am so used to operating on the cylinders of optimism and happy, 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 happy. That's not the worldview of a lot of people. So the situation occurred where the staff member basically needed to take some time off. And I basically told them, because I could see it in their face, you need to take off time. So let's figure out when you're going to take off next week. And they felt forced in that moment. That's not what they wanted. Mm-hmm. And so I learned in that moment of do with and not for, right? How can I do things with you and not for you? It's like working with a client in a sense of self-determination. I should not do things for you if you're not willing to do it for yourself. So how can I create that safe space and pause and accept you for who you are and what you, basically, how do I show up best for you in this moment? Assuming I think I know what you need, but that may not be where you're at.
Yeah, thank you. Andy, I see you nodding. Do you have any thoughts?
No, I agree with that. And I think that's a learned thing. The longer you're in leadership and the more opportunities you have to experience, you know, it's always easy to work with the easy people.
Sure.
The challenge comes from the people who want to push back, you know, and again, it's perceptual. It's based on their experience. And we have to be able to see past that, see to the person. I was going to kind of go down a different, you know, kind of different path as far as answering that initial question with resistance and maybe look at it from more organizational opposed to individual. Yeah. Leading a school through this, you know, it was really important early on. Like I left, you know, when I went to training and I left that training after a week and I was so fired up and ready to scream on, you know, I always tell that story about, you know, I want to stand on my building and just like scream at people. We got to be doing this. We got to be doing this. And understanding that not everybody's in that same headspace. So we had to kind of walk that back and come up with a really good plan. For us, it was about presenting the why. You know, Simon Sinek says, you know, people don't buy what you do, they buy why you do it. And it's always been a driving force for me is making sure to take time to explain the why. We just started to look at data. It's pretty tough to argue with the data. We spent quite a bit of time just really diving into that. I think it's important. My staff at Summit Ridge they were ready. You know, the culture wasn't where it needed to be. We had a lot of discipline just, you know, that was the first thing that I looked at naturally, discipline in our building. And, you know, the year before I came, 200 students approximately that we served that year, 1800 discipline referrals. That's a super high number. And when I asked the staff, what do you feel like you're doing all the time? The obvious answer was dealing with discipline. And so they were ready for it. You know, we were able to move a little quicker because they were ready for it. Since then, when I have opportunities to go out and work with other schools that maybe aren't in that same space, and you get into some of that, because you are with trauma-informed care, really challenging people to view the world differently. Again, when I'm asked, you know, what was the difference at Summit Ridge? The answer is always the adults. We changed. Yeah. You know, we're still working. We still get the same kids, the same types of kids. But the reason why we went from 1800 discipline referrals in that year to served over 200 kids this year, we have 9 discipline referrals for the whole year.
Oh, wow.
It's just a completely different, but we're not focused on that. We've taken the personal out of it, and it's become about the kids. And part of my job in the leadership role is to make sure that I'm also doing that for the adults in the building. Mm-hmm. They are the best versions of themselves when they step into the classroom to really do the work. And so, you know, we spend a lot of time on that, and it's just, you know, I encourage people when they're going through the journey to really take a step back and look at where you're at right now, and then embrace that there might be a better way of doing it. And then here's the information that you need. I can talk to you all day long about the brain, and I can talk to you all day long about, you know, the various components of trauma and ACEs and all that stuff, but you've got to be willing to hear it and then apply it, be willing to apply it. And not everybody's there. Not everybody's there.
Yeah, for sure. Well, you know, there's always that standard, like, curve, right? That you see on graphs, like the people who sort of adopt it early on, and there's a few there, and there's a few that are like way at the bottom, and then there's a whole bunch of people in the middle at all kinds of different places. So you mentioned like ensuring that your staff have, you know, what they need in order to go out and do really good work for your students. So I'm curious what you do. What are some of the strategies or things that you've built up or created in order to support your staff in different ways?
Simple things, from a range, from very simple things to some very, very strategic things. You know, we started, like, for example, last year, you know, on the strategic end with the whole staff, we started, you know, during all the COVID and all the different variations of our schedule, and kids in the building, not in the building, teachers in the building, not in the building. We did Wellness Wednesdays. So there was just an activity or something. And, you know, one time, probably the one that got the best response was told everybody bring a lawn. It was in the spring, bring a lawn chair. We dismissed kids at 1:30, and we just went out and sat in the yard and just talked. I mean, it cost me nothing.
Right.
And the only rule that I had was we're not here to talk about work.
Nice.
So
what?
Anything you want. And it was one of the best received things. You know, we look at, you know, some more specific things that, you know, that we're doing just throughout the course of the year. And just, again, I've learned over time, you know, you can have these big, you know, I can buy them things or I can do for them. Mm-hmm. And they always respond better to the doing for them. Kind of back to Vlad's point, you know, about being understanding what they need, you know, other things that, you know, it's just about being in touch, taking the time to get to know them, and, you know, and that's something we talk about pretty regularly. It'd be pretty hypocritical for me to ask them to build relationships and get to know their kids and learn stories if I wasn't doing the same thing with the adults in my building. And so that's something I take very seriously, because at the end of the day, they're doing the work. I mean,
yeah.
I get to sit here and get interviewed on a podcast about, you know, what's going on, but it's my staff that, you know, I say every year at graduation, you know, some people show up for work, my people show up for kids. And that's incredibly important to me. It's why we've seen the results that we've seen.
Yeah, the relationship.
It's the key.
That leads me into my next question, actually. It's a beautiful segue. I was thinking about how so many times there's this hero mentality, you know, like as the leader, I must, and then fill in the blank, whatever it is. And you've just talked about how it's your team. I wonder if either of you could share a story or some thoughts about how do you co-create vision? How do you decentralize the change process and share leadership among a diverse team of people? You know, how do you build that? And then secondarily, how has that impacted you as the leader when you can let go of having to be the hero? Do you have any thoughts on that? Or Ooh. Have you not been able to let go of being the hero yet?
I was told
you by can see Vlad's face.
I was told by my former boss that it's okay to take off my Superman cape. Mm-hmm. Because I am constantly in a reactive stage of like always trying to save and do more than what I need to. I love that question, Roxanne, because I'm learning more. It's okay to delegate. Like it's okay to your staff learn their strengths, learn their superpowers. I'm a nerd. I will use that, but their capabilities, because there are times where I may have someone on my team that is more efficient at doing something than I am. I can figure it out, but it may drain me. It may pull from me, but it may fill their cup up. So why would I not give them that responsibility, install trust in them? In a sense. And that's, it's actually been helpful in this role. I have a staff actually, I was recently asked to do a career fair at University Academy. And I, during that day, I cannot due to a meeting. And instead of saying no to the counselor, in a previous supervision session, one of my therapists mentioned that that is something that they enjoy doing. They love public speaking. I'm like, oh, I'm all about developing others. So when I saw that email in our team huddle, I just casually threw it out there and I just like waited and waited. And she unmuted herself and said, well, you don't have to twist my arm, Vlad. Of course I'm going to do it. And she's happy. Like it's motivation. I firmly believe that in a work environment to enhance commitment and sustainability, we have to nurture those things. It shouldn't just be about, again, the bottom line. It's important to keep those bills on, but still, how can we pull people in and doing things that they love to do?
I want to comment on that because I'm a chronic overachiever.
Yeah.
And it has been a huge learning for me in the last few years, I would say, especially in recognizing that like when I try to do everything, I'm not going to be as good at the things that I am good at. And not only that, I am restricting people from doing things because I'm jumping in a place where maybe it's not a good fit for me. It's not my strengths. It's not my role. And I don't have to be the one to always say, oh, I'll do it. That's one of those, I don't know, huge ahas that I've had. And as you were talking about that, I was like, yeah, I totally relate to that because letting go of needing to do it all and then recognizing like, look at how great this person does at that sort of thing. And, you know, like get out of the way so that they can shine. I think that's amazing.
I would throw in, I'll use kind of a coaching example. And I learned this, you know, I played sports all the way growing up and through college. And I had the privilege of being around some amazing coaches. One of the things that I learned early on was the best coaches surround themselves with good coaches and they work on player development because you can look like a really, really smart coach if you've got better players than the team you're playing. And so I don't think that's coincidental at all. And so while it's hard sometimes, cause I'm very type A, like I know what I want. I think I know what I need to do to get there. As you are developing that leadership, those assistant coaches and developing your bench, so to speak, putting people in those positions, it makes my job a lot easier. And what I've learned is because I'm a builder by nature, that's who I am. I love the build. I love just the conversation and the digging in and all that stuff and coming up with a plan. And when I did my trauma-informed care class, I still have the sticky paper in my office that I keep where we drew this road from being trauma-informed and with all that stuff. And I had a counselor and a teacher there with me. And it's amazing. Not only did we have a better product because there was input from multiple people, but it allowed me to see things differently as kind of in the leadership position and then go places that I wouldn't have been able to go because I would have been so focused on some of the day-to-day, you know, things that were going on. So it's something that's learned, I think, over time and requires a certain level of confidence to be able to say, you know what, I'm going to put this in the hands of people. But it goes back to, you know, hire the right people and get out of their way and let them do their job, be there to support them. And so I think that's something that I've learned over time.
Yeah, I think those are all things that are just right at the heart of what it means to be trauma-informed, to do trauma-informed caring, because that ability to like see value in other people and to nurture strengths and, you know, being humble and recognizing, you know, where you do need to speak and where you maybe where you don't need to speak. I think those are huge, huge pieces of what it means to be trauma-informed.
Yeah, agreed. Clearly, you both have some realms where you are really succeeding in this implementation journey. I wonder if you can think of or are willing to share any stories of trying to implement a program or a practice when the organization wasn't quite yet ready. And if so, how do you course correct? Because that's something that happens, you know, people get, I think Andy was the one who said it at the very beginning, people are at different places. We're not quite all on the same page. Have you tried to implement something that wasn't quite time yet? Or maybe that wasn't the issue. Maybe there was another issue. Maybe you ignored some kind of deeply held assumption or something else going on in the greater culture. Or maybe even there were some kind of like issues of cultural humility that needed to come in. Like any of those situations, have you tried to implement something and found it not working? And then how did you course correct?
Okay. The first thing that came to mind with that question was, so in my previous work setting, I was very fortunate on being able to create a onboarding system for our department. Within the binder, I had it going back to the why, because I really think that it's paramount for people to know that it's like a compass in a sense, but also just wellness wise. I have not per se created something. I think it's the opposite for me. I saw organizationally, it's hard to put in activities into place. Wellness activities into place if the underlying symptom, right, or the problem is still present. So it's kind of like not addressing the disease, if you will. It's providing prescriptions, but you're not getting to the root of the problem. So it was always a thing I struggled with of, if we're putting in wellness, then what are we looking at as far as people's production or the things that are stressing them out? And someone once mentioned, I was in a meeting once and someone mentioned that they enjoy taking off. They love taking PTO. I do not. I struggle with PTO because it's an illusion.
Wait, trauma. You're the dad of young kids. I think you need to clarify.
This is my trauma stewardship kind of like thinking in a sense, because I know that whenever I come back, the work is there. The work is not changing. So I'm leaving, I'm taking off, and it's compiling, and then I have to come back, and I feel more stressed out than I was when I left. And it's always interesting. And someone in the meeting said that of they can take off all they want to, but it doesn't remove the stressor from the job. Mm-hmm. You can come back feeling better, but then you're still getting into that yuckiness.
So how did you, like, in that situation, then were you able even to get a consensus on what the problem was or the stressor? You know, I hear you say that there were these possibilities for implementing wellness practices, but underlying that was something always driving the uneasiness or the lack of well-being. Were you able to ever come to a consensus on what the problem was?
Not yet. No, because it was system. It was in the system.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. And that's fair. And in fact, what we've learned and what we know is that burnout, for example, is driven by things that happen or don't happen in the system. It's not about individual wellness or even team wellness as much as it is about the system. What about
you? Well, I was just going to hop in and say, and that makes me think of, you know, because he said it, I'm going to tag in the book we keep referring to, which is Burnout by Emily and Amelia Nagoski. And they talk in that book about how we cannot always do anything about those stressors. You know, you take vacation and you come back and that stuff is still there. But you can do something about the stress, about your stress response and, completing that stress response cycle. And I mean, that has been like a huge learning, I would say, for our department in this last year, in thinking just about how we are taking care of ourselves, but then also how we're supporting all these different organizations that are taking care of other people too. It's been a big benefit to us to really consider how do we do that on an ongoing way? Because some of the things we're dealing with systemically are just not going to go away for any length of time. We might be chipping away at some things, right? But a lot of stuff hangs on.
Oh my God. So I love quotes. There's a quote out there that talks about that the person who does not look like they need support are the ones that need support the most. Mm. Like that is, that hits home for me. Mm-hmm. So yes.
Yeah. Thank you. How about you, Andy? Any thoughts about, you know, something that didn't work and trying to figure out how to shift or course correct?
Yeah, I would absolutely, if I were going back and doing it again. So I came back again, ready, on fire, ready to go. And presented, we did kind of an overview of what trauma-informed care was, and this is the direction that we're going, and here's what we're going to do, and this is what we're tackling first, which for us was the discipline piece. I mean, that was the big glaring, mm-hmm. you know, elephant in the room that we just had to really address. And so I come from a behavioral background. I was a special education teacher. I worked with kids with behavior and emotional issues. And so, you know, my whole mind is wrapped around, you know, behavior is predictable, it's functional, it's changeable, and all that mm-hmm. stuff. And we're going to get in and do this. And what I neglected to do was make sure that I was also addressing the trauma and the triggers of my teachers who had been in that environment. Mm-hmm. And were triggered by some of the behavior, you know, where they maybe hadn't felt supported, didn't have the tools to navigate, or, you know, weren't in that, again, going back to that word, that headspace where we were viewing kids through those trauma-informed lenses as opposed to those traditional school discipline lenses. And so I had to take I had to whoa up big time in that, because I tend to attack things pretty aggressively when it comes to that. I'm very passionate about that. And so going back and looking at it, I would have spent way more time on the adults early, mm-hmm. and getting them where they needed to be, at least a better understanding. We have subsequently spent that time, and we do that. It's stuff we review every year. And, you know, some of the wellness stuff that we're doing. You're talking about a book, a book that we've looked at a couple of times throughout the course of the last couple of years is Practicing Presence, which is simple self-care strategies for teachers, written by a teacher who burned out and left the field. She went back and reviewed what it was that caused that to happen. And so there's a lot of just really good tips in there about, you know, talking about burnout and how we can avoid. And so I've put together a whole separate presentation that I do when asked to work with people on that piece, because it is so important. And I can share that story of, man, if I would have had to do this all over again, I would have really spent a lot of time there early. It's kind of like with kids, you know, when you spend, you know, we take the first quarter, we get new kids every quarter, and we start new classes every quarter, and our teachers have permission to spend the first 2 or 3 days of the quarter building relationships and doing wellness activities and doing that stuff. Because what it does on the back end, it buys us so much time on the back end when that relationship's established. And so I would have done that differently for sure. Invest in the people who you're asking to invest in kids.
Yeah, for sure. That makes me think about some conversations we've been having lately around what is productivity really, you know, like how we measure that in our sort of Western civilized way, with numbers and, you know, outcomes and all that quantifiable stuff. And then, you know, when you really get into it, like taking that time to build relationship, to practice well-being with each other, it might not give you some number in an algorithm, right? But in the long run, like how much better is everyone in that system, in that community, in that classroom, you know, whatever it might be.
No, but it will give you better data algorithm, because people that are happy are going to be far more productive.
Absolutely.
Are going to be far more productive. And
I firmly believe in that.
No different with kids. You know, it's like I always, you know, I get asked a question about how do I pick the right people to come to Summit Ridge Academy? Mm-hmm. All right. And this is kind of off on a tangent, but I'll bring it back. So when I get a chance to interview teachers, I get an hour to interview a teacher. Right. So I'll tell the story of my English teacher. He's been in my building for 3 years. He is a card-carrying, flag-waving member of the trauma-informed you know, community. He is all on board. He does a lot for our building. He's great for kids. And I get done interviewing him after 50 minutes or so of the interview. And we get to the part where I say, well, do you have any questions for us? And he looks at me and he says, 50 minutes. You didn't ask me a single question about teaching English. And I said, well, did you notice a theme in the questions that I asked? And he said, yeah, they were about relationships. They were about kids. They were about situational things. And I said, that's right. I can tell whether you have a heart for kids. I can tell whether you can teach English by looking at your resume and calling your supervisor. What I get 50 minutes to do is get at your heart for kids.
Oh, wow.
So essential. So we talk about that, but then do we do that in practice? And so it's so very important to identify the right people and then take good care of them. People are more important than things, but it's amazing when you do take care of people, the things get taken care of too.
Exactly.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. Yeah. That makes me, that leads me to another question, which is then, do you have stories or can you share with us how you celebrate, how you make time to point out what has changed, what has gone right? You know, instead of, it seems very normal to focus on what we need to fix or what has gone wrong. And so I'm wondering both on an individual and an organizational level, if you can speak to either of those. Do you take the time? How do you take the time? How do you mark those milestones of change so that people can feel good about the change and growth, or that you can feel good about the change and growth?
One thing that I have adapted from my old job to this job is gratitudes and kudos. So I start my team huddles all the time with any, like basically asking staff, do we have any gratitudes, any kudos, client success stories? Because you're right, there are times that we are so driven by the work that we're doing that we forget we have our own personal things that we can celebrate too, whether it's connecting with another staff member, right? That level of thank you, you see me, I see you situation. Mm-hmm. So that's an individual for me. And this is going off a little tangent, I'll bring it back too, but even for our daughter, because I firmly believe these need to happen on a very fundamental level. And it's just start for kids. Whenever she gets off school, we'll ask her, what was her high and low points for today? Mm-hmm. Like, what was the good and what was the bad, in a sense? Organizationally, that's still something that I'm exploring at my new role here. We do actually ask that question in our bigger staff meetings for the organization of, are there any good stories or client-driven stories in a sense?
I love that when you said the thing about like seeing each other, I see you and you see me, because just yesterday I had that experience in our team huddle, which brought me to tears. And I'm actually tearing up a little bit now just thinking about that when you said that, because one of our colleagues had a gratitude that she expressed for some conversations that she and I have had. And it was just so, I am exceedingly grateful for those conversations. And, you know, so much of that has been very individual between the two of us, but being able to share that with the rest of our team. And, you know, we have a culture in our team that's close and connected because we have fostered those kinds of things over many years now. And so, you know, being able to share that experience with everyone then on the team, like that's, I can't even describe it in words. Tears are rolling down my face now. So that probably describes it
the way
it's meant to, right?
That is the description in itself. Oh, and I should have noted, like organizationally, this is a practice I have adapted from University Health, like the gratitude cards that we would do. Mm-hmm. I told my boss about them, like, we need to do this on an organizational level. Can we do this? And she loved the idea. And so now we have gratitude cards that we are giving out. So
how about you, Andy? Do you have any ways that you celebrate or, you know, just kind of remind people that there are positive outcomes? And because sometimes culture change takes so much time and it seems to sometimes move at a very slow pace, and we can lose sight of the fact that we're actually changing.
Yeah, I think I need to get, I'll start with an admission. You know, the formal recognition of something that I need to work on and get better at. It's something I think about and I try to do. I do a lot of individual things, you know, just individual conversations with people. but there are ways that we can certainly, you know, ways that I could be better at that. One of the things that I started very quickly once we got into this whole move towards trauma-informed care was to really spend some time when we come back in the fall, just to review the previous year. We look at our data, we look at, you know, we see the decline in discipline referrals. We see the increase in the number of kids we're working with. We see the opportunities that we're, you know, providing for kids. And so I try to do that every year. Just as a reminder, guys, I know we don't talk about this all the time, but here's what the data says. And this is the validation for your work. Or, hey, you know, a year ago, we were really good here and we kind of slipped a little bit. So be ready. Let's have some conversations about that. But I think it's something I try to do. Again, I try to do little things that maybe aren't as specific to, they're just more general thank yous to staff. You know, we do parent teacher conferences every quarter. I usually buy Route 44s for everybody for parent teacher conference. You know, just I like to do little things like that. Mm-hmm. I'm a competitive barbecuer. And so they tend to enjoy whenever I decide to cook for the staff. So try to just do thank yous like that, just to show them that they're appreciated and that, you know, that we recognize. I end every building level email anytime I'm sharing information with the tagline at the bottom. It says, thank you for all you do for kids and for each other. Just as a reminder, it's just kind of become my thing, right? And I have a couple teachers that give me a hard time about it, but obviously that it's effective if they're harassing me about it, but just
that's look, right. They're reading it.
They're reading it and they're reading it to the end because it's the last line of the email. So that's a positive, you know, but again, something I think it's something we can always get better at is finding those opportunities to really point out the good that people are doing.
Thank you. What an excellent discussion we've been having today. So Andrea and I want to sum up a few takeaways. The first takeaway is about coaching your team. And remember, that's a team that you might officially lead or just a team that you influence. And that takeaway is to coach with compassion versus coaching for compliance. We talked about remembering to counter individual resistance by caring for the human being with dignity, noting their worth versus solely caring about their productivity. And we talked also about when you're having a challenging encounter, viewing that person as your kind teacher, not a challenging person, but someone who has something to teach you. So coaching with compassion versus coaching for compliance.
And then our second takeaway is around how we bring trauma-informed care into our places, our spaces, wherever we are, and really trying to sell it, I guess, by acknowledging like where are the pain points, what's hurting, and what's the why? Why is it that this seems like a possible solution? You know, what are the reasons that are really grounded in the data that we have access to, all the different kinds of data that we might encounter, and really understanding that not everybody's going to be on the same page. And so we may have to shift our messaging a little bit depending on who we're talking to and what they have experienced, maybe in terms of organizational trauma in the past, what they're currently experiencing in their day-to-day, and really finding opportunities in there to come to some common understanding, having a shared vision.
Yes. And the third takeaway has to do with letting go of the hero mentality. Learning your staff's strengths and letting them lead from those. As you delegate, you instill trust, and that enhances commitment and supports sustainability. And when you let go of having to do everything, you make space for other people to do things where they are gifted and where they may even do those things better than you could have. So remembering that the best coaches surround themselves with good coaches and work on player development, that people who are happy are naturally more productive. And so making first things first, which means investing in your team, caring for them before asking them to care for others.
And we have a fourth takeaway today, which tags into that last one, but it's worth having a separate point about, which is how do we celebrate the things that we have accomplished? How do we acknowledge where we have gratitude and where we have kudos for one another, and really taking time to honor that and give space for it? And again, I loved what Vlad said about, you know, those opportunities to be seen and to see one another, and how that just builds our community and it builds our capacity to be able to show up and do trauma-informed caring in every aspect of our work and our lives too. So once again, Vlad and Andy, thank you so much for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thank you. This is a great opportunity.
It was a really enjoyable conversation. And we invite our listeners to visit our website, the Mid-America ATTC website, where you can also find a link to our virtual room of refuge. And there you can find a variety of support for your own well-being, access to our YouTube channel, and you can also subscribe to our newsletter, Conscious Connections, there. Thanks for joining us. It is our hope that where you work and where you live, this podcast will offer you practical support for the practice of trauma-informed caring.